Here's Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Friday, October 7th, 2011, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And as we do every Friday, we are ready for this week's Federal News Countdown. This week, my experts counting down their choices for the three most important federal news stories of the week are Alan Baludis of Cisco and Rob Burton of the law firm Venable. It's good to see both of you gentlemen again. And I didn't realize until Alan pointed it out earlier in the week that you guys, last time you guys were on the countdown, you were on together.
Yeah,
so we were.
It's like,
we were.
It's like a reunion.
I think we had a good time. And I actually got to ride back downtown in a cab with Rob. I was really thrilled he picked up the tab for the cab.
Wow.
Which I thought was very nice of him. Until the following week, I got a bill for over $900, which was his time billable hours plus the cab fare.
Right.
It was
worth it, I think.
I was shocked and appalled.
As you spend a lot of time shocked and appalled for some reason.
I
don't know why that is. It's great to have both of you on the show today, gentlemen. I appreciate your time. We have a slight calamity to start off the countdown with. We have a crew of singers that sing the numbers, and they're only going to sing two numbers today. Apparently, some union thing, and they didn't get scale they were supposed to.
Might be part of the government downsizing.
Well, it hasn't
downsized some of the singers.
It hasn't affected choruses, to my knowledge, yet. But at any rate, we start the countdown off, as we always do, with the number three, third most important federal news story of the week. And, Alan, yours is from Government Computer News. And the headline is, in hard times, state CIOs gain clout survey finds. And I at first didn't see the connection to the federal government, but I think I did. Tell me how you're drawing this connection.
Well, I found this to be an interesting report emerging from NASCO and Tech America and such, and I think it was an important thing in challenging times in the state. But the thing that struck me was, as you know, Francis, I've been complaining about the state of federal CIOs and contending that the Clinger-Cohn legislation really needed to be revisited. This report gave me hope that in this time of budget crunches and financial cutbacks looming on the federal level, that in fact something very similar will happen, that people will see the all that CIOs bring to the table, the opportunity that IT presents as a great enabler, and that our federal CIOs will gain real clout during these challenging times that are certainly going to face us in the coming months and years.
I had Paul Christman from Quest Software on the program yesterday. He was at this conference, and they do a lot of business both with the federal government and with state and local governments. And he talked about that very thing, where he's seeing on the state level, the job of CIO really is an executive job and not a tech job anymore. And the functions of the CIO are interwoven with the other members of the C-suite. Is that the model that you're thinking about?
That, in fact, is the model. And I think in many cases, states did a much better job years ago of implementing the CIO position. And we've seen this ourselves in the state of Virginia, that was the Commonwealth of Virginia, that was one of the first to do so, and that is they made the CIO a cabinet-level official. It was the Undersecretary for Technology, was part of the governor's cabinet, had the proverbial coveted seat at the table. They were often given real clout over the portfolio, not only IT infrastructure investment, but technology broadly defined, technology as an enabler to change the way we do business in transportation, in education, in healthcare, and the like. So I think states and NASCO have actually been far ahead of federal government agencies and the federal CIO councils in making CIOs a real meaningful, influential position, and really achieving there the same type of thing that Clinger-Cohn was intended to achieve at the federal level.
Alan Belutis is story number three on the countdown, is headlined in Hard Times, State CIOs Gain Clout. That's from Government Computer News. Rob Burton, your story number three is Jason Miller's story, headlined OFPP Takes on Challenge of Taming Macs, Multiple Award Contracts. This is kind of the next generation of OFPP looking at a number of different contracts, isn't it?
Well, I have a particular interest in this, Francis, because before I retired from OFPP, we were pushing legislation to actually have business cases for all multiple award contracts. And we got that legislation through in the 2008 Defense Authorization Act, where Congress said, hey, you got to have a business case for all these interagency contract vehicles. Now, way back in time, Clinger Cohen had such a requirement for GWACs, government-wide acquisition contracts, which are just for IT specific. And as you may recall, the business case, they're only like six GWACs. So there are very few GWACs, and I could not understand when I was at OFPP why we didn't have business cases for all interagency contracts. Why just GWACs? Well, it's because the congressional requirement, the statutory requirement, was just for GWACs. Now it's broader. So here you now have OFPP implementing. My only thought on this, Francis, is I think a couple of opportunities were missed here. One is just looking prospectively. It's not looking at current multiple award contracts, and there are a lot of them. One thing we learned, because we did a survey back in 2008, and there were a lot of them, and they were duplicative. And so this doesn't really correct the ones that are in existence and try to reduce the number in existence. It will reduce probably the ones in the future. The second thing that troubled me as far as another missed opportunity is the fact that we're not having a government-wide board take a look at these business cases. The business cases will be reviewed at the agency level, which somewhat defeats the whole purpose, because we wanted some government-wide group looking at all of these government-wide vehicles to decide, gee, should there be another one, or should there be fewer? And I think agencies have such a vested interest, I'm not sure they're going to be terribly objective, and the business cases may be geared to ensuring the outcome the agency wants. Now, I realized that OFPP didn't have the resources to do business case reviews for all of these vehicles, and I had proposed maybe some type of interagency group reporting to the Chief Acquisition Officers Council and actually doing the heavy lifting and giving a report to the Chief Acquisition Officers Council. I still think something like that is needed in order to really get management control over all of these vehicles.
Is it possible, though, that rather than being a missed opportunity, the concept that you talked about first, where this is more forward-looking than looking backward, is it possible? I mean, rule number one, if you're trying to get out of a hole, is you stop digging. Is it possible that that's the concept at work here, and that once we are in a situation where we know we're not creating new ones that aren't necessary, that then you can go back and look and see what's already there and start to either consolidate or eliminate?
Well, I think it's a good point, Francis. It's a good point. It's not like it's too late.
Right.
And maybe that does make some sense. I do think it's something that shouldn't be ignored, though. You know, I think it's at some point we got to look at the inventory that's currently there. But it's certainly something that could be done eventually.
All right. Rob Burton's story number three in the countdown is from Federal News Radio's Jason Miller. It's headlined, OFPP Takes on Challenge of Taming Macs, and you can read it and all of the articles that we're counting down on the show today on federalnewsradio.com on the in-depth page. The second most important federal news story of the week is chosen by Alan Belutis and Rob Burton when we come back on the Federal News Countdown.
This is John Gilroy from Federal Tech Talk. You know, I've done over 200 interviews here on Federal News Radio, but many listeners still ask, yes, John, but what does your company do? Well, my company is called Armature. For the past decade, we have worked with organizations to help improve the way they collect data. You may call it comprehensive data collection, data analysis, or even outcomes measurements. If your agency has any problems with collecting, analyzing, or displaying data, then please visit our website at armaturecorp.com. We can help.
Three things to know about the proposed merger of AT&T and T-Mobile. With the planned merger, AT&T will invest $8 billion more and deploy the next generation of wireless internet to nearly everyone in America. This investment will create as many as 96,000 American jobs. We're not investing to create jobs, but jobs will be created because we're investing. AT&T.
This week's Experts in Health topic is prostate health, featuring Dr. Antonio Michel, urologist with the Mid-Atlantic Permanente Medical Group at the Kaiser Permanente Falls Church Medical Center.
Prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men. While the causes of prostate cancer are unknown, risk factors such as age, race, ethnicity, and family history may increase a man's chance of getting prostate cancer. Prostate cancer is most commonly found in men age 65 or older and occurs in African-American men more frequently than men of any other race. Prostate cancer is usually curable when detected early. Regular health checkups, including a digital rectal exam of the prostate and a PSA blood test, are vital to early detection. We at Kaiser Permanente encourage men to be proactive about their health and maintain regular health checkups with their doctor. Be well and thrive.
To learn more about Kaiser Permanente's Experts in Health, visit kp.org/midatlantic and click Meet Our Doctors.
The Government IT Solutions Spotlight is brought to you by CDWG.
The White House turns to interns to improve their software development process. White House Chief Information Officer Brooke Colangelo says on a blog on CIO.gov that four computer science students created the Software Automation and Technology, or SWAT, team to help improve agency business systems more quickly. The group used an agile development approach to work on 40 different projects over the summer. Colangelo says the SWAT team revolutionized their business process support and software development services.
If you're in federal IT, you know that every internet connection and every mobile device poses a threat to your data. Visit cdwg.com/security to learn how our security experts use the latest technology to help keep your agency ahead of those threats. CDWG. People who get it.
Visit CDWG.com to learn how SonicWall VPN technologies can allow your agency to securely transmit data without the risk of being corrupted or hijacked.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Monday's Federal Drive. We'll talk to a man ranked as one of the top 100 federal managers ever. He's an editor of a new book, Transforming American Governance, Rebooting the Public Square. Plus, for the Columbus Day holiday, we'll present some of the best interviews of the past week. Those stories and more Monday morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My experts on the Federal News Countdown panel this week are Rob Burton of Venable and Alan Baludis of Cisco, both, of course, former executives in the federal government and experts in the world of the federal government. And now I'm going to try this. The chorus is here, and they have kind of arms crossed and scowls on their faces, but just give us a try here. All right, cooperative there as we get to the second most important federal news story of the week, as chosen by Alan Baludis. And the headline is U.S. lawmaker says China cyber espionage intolerable. And, we're starting to see voices, Alan, that are talking about what people didn't seem to want to talk about for a long time, aren't we?
That was the key for me in selecting this story. I know on your show a number of times, cybersecurity issues, policies, threats, hacks have come up again and again by some of my counterparts who have been here before. But I thought this story and was important because, in fact, most of the threats come from a relatively small number of countries. And it, clearly they come from Korea. We've seen that. But high on the list, too, of where a number of these probes, especially into government systems, are coming from are from Israel, are from France, and are clearly from China. And nobody has wanted to say something about that before, either because of the public sector sensitivities about our challenging relationships with China, especially as it emerges as a true superpower, and likely because of the intertwining in the private sector of companies who either want to do business with China or, in fact, are already located there and have offshored a good bit of their manufacturing work to that nation. Mm-hmm. So I thought this was an important step by somebody who I liken this to the emperor's new clothes kinds of things.
Yeah.
To actually say what a lot of people know, what a lot of people talk about, and to really get it out there so we can begin to discuss this as a serious and important issue.
Well, and neither one of the members of Congress that are quoted in this Reuters story put any airs on about this. The chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Congressman Mike Rogers, obviously Republican, China's economic espionage has reached an intolerable level, and I believe that the United States and our allies in Europe and Asia have an obligation to confront Beijing and demand they put a stop to this piracy. And then the ranking member, Dutch Ruppersberger from Baltimore County, we basically feel very strongly that we're being attacked in an aggressive way by China, possibly Russia, and other countries. I mean, they just really laid it out there. There's no mistake where they're standing. And as I said, I find that 180 degrees opposite of where we were for a long time about talking about potential cyber espionage, particularly from China.
Well, that is why I picked it as my number 2222 story here.
What do we gain by getting that out there and on the record? I mean, I can't believe China doesn't know that we know. So if each side that's involved is aware of what's going on, what's to be gained by talking about it in a forum like this?
You know, I think we can point to a lot of issues that we have dealt with previously in this nation, which for the longest time, they would only be dealt with indirectly or covertly or behind closed doors. And sometimes to really fully address them properly, you need to get it out on the table. You need to talk very honestly and frankly about it. As Mike Hayden, former CIA director, pointed out, China itself is the victim of a number of cyber attacks. So I think this is an important enough global issue that it would really benefit from people being more frank and forthcoming, putting their cards out on the table. That's really the only way we're going to address it. And it's such a political governmental threat. It's such an industrial competitiveness threat. It's a challenge on so many levels that I think we're best served as a global economy today and as a global community in addressing this head on. And I see this as being an important step in us beginning to do so.
One of the elements that I thought was particularly noteworthy was actually the very last sentence of the story. After the hearing, Rogers, Chairman Mike Rogers, told reporters he was very concerned about plans by General Electric to have a joint venture with a Chinese aviation company, given the Chinese track record on intellectual property theft. Obviously, General Electric doesn't share the same concern that Chairman Rogers does.
I think there was a separate story on this very issue, front page story in the Post, about this matter and some of the challenges for GE in beginning to, which is such an important American defense firm, in beginning to do so, and how this issue would be handled, because again, the Chinese track record in the intellectual property arena is not a very stellar one.
Well, at least not when it comes to other people's intellectual property.
Again, the helicopter that was downed in Pakistan and the in the assassination, there, recalled among the first visitors to Pakistan were members of the Chinese military establishment to view the remnants of that helicopter with its stealth technologies.
Yeah. Alan Baludis' story number two on the countdown is headline, U.S. lawmaker says China cyber espionage intolerable. It's posted on federalnewsradio.com on the in-depth page right now. Rob Burton's story number two when we come back on the countdown on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Where did you leave it? Where could it have possibly gone? It's frustrating because you used to have your motivation with you all the time, and now, that's okay. We'll help you find it. First, let's find your reason. You know, your reason What's that thing that makes you want to live to an age where you can say whatever you want to whomever you want and somehow it becomes charming? Next, find your thing. What is that healthy thing you actually love doing? There's got to be one, right? Finally, go find your partner. Who's the ping to your pong? The downward to your dog? Who'll keep your butt moving and vice versa? Find all of those things. We're pretty sure your motivation will magically appear. But if you're still having trouble finding it, try looking really, really hard in the mirror. We're Kaiser Permanente, and we're here to help you find your motivation to thrive. Visit kp.org/thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
And now Ask the CIO, brought to you by Vion Corporation.
Chad Sheridan is the CIO of the USDA's Risk Management Agency. He says the agency sped up the time it takes to process crop insurance claims.
We simplified some of the calculations and improved the speed calculationally. I think that brought us probably about a factor of two or so improvement. That's where I think we're going to get more bang for the buck later. The next thing we do is we implemented a new set of servers in our production environment. That bought us probably a factor of 2 to 3 improvement in processing speed.
Sound familiar?
Where's my data stored? Who owns it? How many duplicates exist? How much file data is unused? How are we going to pay for all of it?
Vion Corporation's Capacity Services is the answer. Your organization needs a trusted advisor with the right technical tools and the right financial expertise to solve big storage problems for good. For over 31 years, Vion Corporation and Hitachi Data Systems have been planning and preparing to solve big data problems for the government at the exabyte level. Visit Vion.com to learn more. That's Vion.com.
The 12th Annual Excellence in Partnership Awards is October 26th at the Crystal Gateway Marriott in Arlington, Virginia. The Excellence in Partnership Awards honor those who have excelled at promoting partnership in government procurement. A special tribute to Mythbusters for those who embody effective communication between government and industry. Come celebrate at this special event for the government contracting community and the Multiple Award Schedules program. Register now for the Excellence in Partnership Awards at eipawards.com.
Fighting on. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss. With HHS HealthBeat, some things change during a marriage, but a study indicates that the amount of fighting the couples do is not among them. Researcher Claire Camp Dush of Ohio State University saw this in 20 years of data on about 1,000 couples.
Levels of conflict were pretty stable. There wasn't much change over time. So once a couple had a level of conflict, they tended to maintain that.
This isn't necessarily great news for couples who don't fight and bad news for couples who do. Camp Dush says being involved with each other's lives is important, even if it's with fights. And higher quality marriages work out ways to have more sharing of chores and decisions. The study in the Journal of Family Issues was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
How can federal agencies drive performance in a cutback climate? What are the latest best practices for maximizing efficiency in federal programs? Join HUD Secretary Sean Donovan and hundreds of federal managers to learn how to achieve more with less at Excellence in Government, the Efficiency Imperative, on November 17th in Washington, D.C. Register today to save 35% at www.excelgov.com.
Headed to Fort Detrick or the I-270 Technology Corridor, Federal News Radio can be heard crystal clear on 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. It's the same great station, just on an added frequency. Get the latest news about the federal government and government contractors. Hear exclusive interviews with the movers and shakers in the federal arena. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM or 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. Federal News Radio, your source for federal news now.
We're back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown features two experts from the world of the federal government every Friday afternoon at 3. They choose the three most important federal news stories of the week. In their view, they rank them in order from number 3 to number 1, and we count them down in studio on the Federal News Countdown. This week it's Alan Balutis from Cisco and Rob Burton from Venable. And Rob Burton, your story number 2 is my colleague Jared Serbu's coverage of Deputy Secretary Bill Lynn on his next to last day as deputy secretary, speaking at the Center for American Progress and talking about where DOD is headed budget-wise and the potential cuts at that agency. You're a DOD vet yourself. What do you make of not just what Secretary Lynn said, but of all of the conversations that are going on about where the defense budget might go?
Well, Chris, I sort of enjoyed this. I don't know that the secretary said anything earth-shattering, but I always enjoy looking at what someone has to say as they're leaving the federal government, because I find, for instance, they tend to be a little bit more open frank about their experiences. And I hope what the secretary said here, I thought, really was very important, and I'm hoping it gets some traction on Capitol Hill. Because the bottom line is DOD has to cut big time. And right now, as Secretary Lynn pointed out, they're focused on discretionary spending. That means let's put a freeze on government employees' salaries. Let's make sure they don't have training. I mean, this is discretionary type spending where the cuts seem to always come first. And they're looking for $450 billion here. And you're not going to get it, just like Secretary Lynn said, through discretionary spending cuts. So the hard choices have to be made really on Capitol Hill in the final analysis. And you know how this works. There are pet DOD programs that politicians are pushing that sometimes benefit their particular constituencies back in their home states. And it just has to be cuts. And Congress is going to have to take a leadership role here in making some very hard decisions. But I do think the deputy secretary made a very good point. The time is now. You know, we always talk about cutting the DOD budget. I mean, how many decades have we talked about it? But I really do think it's different now.
But
I think it's quite serious.
But while it's doubled, even not including war expenses in the past decade, I look at this to some extent as some saber rattling on the Defense Department's side. You've already seen statements from Secretary Panetta on the same issue of not only the budget cuts they're facing, which they think they may be able to accommodate, but those that would come in if the super committee can't agree on array of cuts to meet the requirements, and this automatic sequester cuts in, which would cut another $600 billion out of the Department of Defense budget over the next decade, on top of the almost $400 billion in cuts that have been agreed to as part of the deal reached to date.
Right. And I thought it was interesting that Secretary Lynn, though, did say he thought there was an area where there should be increased spending. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned cybersecurity, which sort of goes into Alan's other story. It's going to go into my top story for the week. That's interesting, because where are we going to be able to get more money for anything? Mm-hmm. But his point is well taken. In the cybersecurity area, there clearly is a need. And he also, in a different interview, Francis, talked about public-private partnership to address some of the challenges of cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. And here is an area, too, where I think the government's got to do more of this, actually having public-private partnerships, because cybersecurity is such a challenge that it really can only be addressed by leveraging the innovation and talents of the private sector. And I think the government really needs to really believe that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that Jared points out in this story from this speech on Tuesday with Secretary Lynn was one of the things that I talked to him. I had an interview with him on Monday on the show, and he mentioned the same thing in our conversation. Jared writes, Lynn said separating the Pentagon's must-haves from the nice-to-haves is hard enough inside the building. There's a lot of debate about even what the classifications of must-haves and nice-to-haves are, and whether some of the must-haves can go onto the nice-to-have list and thereby go away. A lot of debate about, you know, if we have 15 times as many of a particular type of piece of equipment as all the other countries in the world combined, is that necessary, and do they need to continue to be refreshed, and so on and so forth? So even all of that stuff, Rob, isn't set in stone yet, is it?
No, absolutely not. And most everybody thinks they have a must-have, or everything's a critical function.
Right.
I mean, nobody wants to say they're working on something that's not important.
Right.
And so the people, I think it's a problem both inside the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill, that everybody thinks that a program's critical and it's a must-have. Otherwise, why is it there in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much that OMB has issued recently that talks about saving money through increased efficiencies. And here again, Secretary Lynn, I think, was right on the money. He said, hey, we're not going to get there with the kind of cuts we need to get through improved operations and efficiencies. Mm-hmm. That's not going to cut it.
Yeah.
And he's absolutely right.
Yeah. Does this sound to you, Alan, like a step beyond what Secretary Gates was talking about as he started on this effort? Now, I guess it's been about a year and a half ago since he first started.
I think Secretary Gates started the ball rolling on this. And, of course, Secretary Lynn was part of those decisions and discussions, but I think it picks up on the point I tried to make earlier, which is the deficit reduction ball has gotten rolling and gathered increased momentum. And as I said, if the super committee can't come to an agreement and some of these broader sequesters come in, you know, as Secretary Panetta noted, it does create almost like a doomsday device.
Mm-hmm.
Because it puts in place these automatic sequesters, half of which will come from the Department of Defense. So I think Rob is right. We have some very, very difficult decisions that we will need to make in the next couple of months, and then we'll have to see how they play out. Although I think the one kind of condition in this is that they play out over 10 years, and we don't really do 10-year budgets in the United States. This isn't the former Soviet Union. So a lot of these things are going to be revisited by new Congresses and new presidents. And by that, I mean even President Obama, if there is a second term, is going to be a different executive with a different cabinet than he is now.
Can Secretary Panetta be going maybe a little bit too far with the doomsday stuff? Is there potential for backlash there where members of Congress will go, man, he's really overdoing it and this must not be as bad as it sounds?
I would say I'd be interested in Rob's view. I mean, Secretary Panetta is one of the cagiest, most seasoned political appointees you're going to find in this cabinet. He's served as head of the Office of Management and Budget. He's served in the White House. I got to believe he knows exactly what he is doing at this point.
I mean, the bottom line, Francis, is that as goes DOD, goes the rest of the federal government. And mm-hmm. if DOD just can't get it together, and if DOD can't make the hard choices and the cuts, I mean, the civilian agencies probably aren't either.
Yeah. Well, I thought Secretary Lynn's answer, I asked him about sequestration on Monday, and I said, what's the contingency there? And he said, well, we have a plan in place, but he didn't go to the doomsday scenario that Secretary Panetta has gone to on a number of occasions. I thought that was an interesting little just kind of differentiation in the message there.
I thought part of the selection of Ash Carter to serve in the deputy secretary role reflected the fact that down the road, they were going to have to make some of these hard decisions, which clearly are going to have big impacts on some of the DOD contracts and contractors and some of the big plans for the future. And I think Deputy Secretary Carter is one of the people well positioned to help lead and guide that series of steps.
Rob Burton's story number two on the countdown is my colleague Jared Serbu's story from federalnewsradio.com. Headlined, Lynn says DOD must cut budget but without mistakes of the past. And you can read it and all of the stories on the countdown this week on federalnewsradio.com on the in-depth page. The number one story of the week as chosen by Alan Baludis and also as chosen by Rob Burton when the Federal News Countdown continues on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
After a long preparation period, the Department of Veterans Affairs is beginning to roll out a new generation of smartphones and tablet devices. VA is taking it slow. They plan to issue about 1,000 new devices, mostly iPhones and iPads, over the coming year. And to make sure the devices don't expose VA to data breaches, they'll be limited to a couple functions for the time being. They'll handle secure, encrypted email and data viewing without the ability to store information on the devices.
General
Dynamics Information Technology is dedicated to providing the latest, highest quality information technology services and resources to help organizations meet their mission objectives. Large-scale IT systems and communications networks are the strategic and operational heart of defense, intelligence, civilian government, and private business. They require the expertise of a company that delivers results. General Dynamics Information Technology and professional services. Go to GDIT.com to learn more. That's GDIT.com.
Taking a family of five to the amusement park can cost a small fortune.
Oh, yeah. So to save some money, we thought, hey, let's bring the amusement park to us.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
All right. Step right up. Step right up, young man. Are you ready to ride the Wacky Waterfall?
That's just the bathtub with the shower head running.
Nope, it's the Wacky Waterfall.
It's a shower, Dad.
Waterfall.
Wacky.
There's an easier way to save. Get online. Go to Geico.com. Get a quote. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Newsmakers, talk to Jason Miller.
David Hinson is the director of the Minority Business Development Agency.
The White House is going to set up a new businessusa.gov site. There are many departments. The government does a lot to provide a lot of services to a lot of different people with very specific needs. There's still more work that needs to be done to help people understand the broad range of services and support that the government provides, particularly to minority-owned businesses and small businesses.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/federal. Drive.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown with Alan Baludis and Rob Burton. And during the last commercial break, we did finally reach an agreement with the singers. So I don't have to worry about them giving me a hard time anymore. And they're ready to sing.
Number one.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Alan Baludis, is from Government Executive, and it is their list of the 20 all-time greatest feds. And, Alan, I'm ashamed to say that there were some names here that I didn't recognize. There were some names that I had to learn from this story why they were important. I'm happy to say there are a couple names on the list that I've interviewed and had the pleasure of talking to and getting to know.
You still have room to learn and grow, Francis.
Well, I always do. I'm a lifelong learner, is what I am, Alan, for your information. But you sent me a note when you sent this story that it's not just the story in and of itself important.
The story itself, I thought, was a wonderful and touching one because like you, I kind of wanted to go through the list and see people like Wilbur Cohn, who was the person who built Medicare, Doc Cook, the mayor at the Pentagon, who I had the chance to work with earlier in my career in government, Dr. Anthony Fauci out at the National Institute of Health, who's still an important contributor. Constant Barry Newman over at the Office of Personnel Management, Elmer Stotz, who just passed away a very short time ago, who was the Comptroller General of the United States at GAO and a major figure at OMB, and Dwight Enke, who known as Mr. Implementation, who I recently had the honor and privilege of completing a book manuscript with. But this hit me in a couple of ways because at a time when the contributions of career officials seem so often deprecated and unappreciated, I thought it was important to note some of the people that had made such an important contribution over the years and how they've really helped change not only our government but our nation. But to me, it also got into the fact that we've seen the increased politicization of senior appointees in government in the last several administrations that spanned both parties. You know, I'm struck by the fact that so many senior jobs that really used to be career reserve jobs or career positions are now political positions or filled by political appointees.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes senior jobs that in my days in the human resources and in the grants and the loans arena were deemed so important that they could only be filled by a careerist.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, too, I've been struck by some of the reports on the scandals in the grant and loan program at Energy, how so many of the early warnings seem to have been sounded by career people at Energy and at the Office of Management and Budget, while people in the senior political ranks at Energy and at the White House itself just seem to be pushing on and on and on, kind of oblivious to the political bombshell that they were dealing with and the political, the possible problems for the government and for the president if they continued down these tracks. Mm-hmm. So I think in many ways, career people, especially those in the senior ranks, often have better political judgment because they're in this for the long haul. They have the long-term stewardship view toward government mm-hmm. than short-term political appointees do who are only in for 18 to 24 months.
Rob, the most recent example of this that I've experienced was a conversation I had with Jeff Neal, who recently retired as the Chief Human Capital Officer at DHS. And as part of our series on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, I talked to him about working at DHS and his experience there. And one of the things he brought up was when he left that job, it was his view that that was not a position that was well suited to be a political appointee. He was a political appointee, but he said this really should be a career position. And he made his case to Secretary Napolitano and to Rafael Borras, and they indeed did that, converted it back. And the response that I got to that from people who said, wow, this is just a huge deal, just kind of reinforced in my mind that the idea in this day and age of transitioning a job from a political appointee back to a career position really is almost foreign to a lot of people.
Which is odd. I mean, it is odd because I think, of course, I guess I'm biased because I was a career person for 30-some years.
Uh-huh.
But I think career folks bring an enormous amount of value, and political appointees have to rely on them. There's no question about that. And I think that a lot of these positions, like Jeff's position, and I would say most of the chief acquisition officer positions, mm-hmm. they should be career positions. I mean, mm-hmm. you're talking about a real professional discipline where somebody needs to be there for an extended period of time. You know, the average time for a political appointees 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they come and they go, which is fine. But when they fill so many of these types of management positions that really are running a profession in the federal government,
right.
like acquisition, I think there's risk. I think there's a lot of risk not to have career people in those types of positions.
I'd take issue with Rob on one part of what he just said, which is that they're there for 18 to 22 months, and that's fine. I don't think it is fine when many of the IT implementations we're trying to do, the financial management problems in the government, the nurturing and now replacing a whole generation in the workforce, those aren't issues you can deal with in 18 to 22 months.
Mm-hmm.
Those are issues where you really need years and years and years.
Well,
I think you need the continuity.
The thing is, it's not going to happen, though, Alan. With the political appointees, when I say it's fine, I mean it's a reality.
Yeah.
It's a reality. It's not going to change.
It's not good, necessarily.
You can make it less than 18 to 22
yeah.
months.
I'm not so sanguine that it's not going to change. I actually have some hopes that some of these fiscal challenges that we'll face and the need to streamline and reinvent government as opposed to just cutting it will lead us to revisit some of these issues. But we'll discuss that on our next show together.
Well, of course, we just talked about Secretary Lynn's departure. But, I mean, the point is that mm-hmm. they simply don't stay for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
And it's also hard to attract people into the federal government in political positions.
Well, because
the Obama administration had a lot of challenges
in that regard. Process, yeah.
Yeah, I do want to say I congratulate Jeff for those actions. But I do know that Jeff Neal's history was as a career
yes.
HR official in government. He spent a number of years in the career ranks before accepting this as a political
and, yeah,
job.
And that gave him, I think, the insight to be able to say to his uppers, this is what we got to do here. Alan Baludis, you mentioned you chose as your number one story to use as a jumping off point the list of the 20 all-time greatest feds from GovExec, and you can read that list linked up at federalnewsradio.com on the in-depth page. Rob Burton's story number one. We'll wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown next on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Do you know us? You count on our technology every day. The office elevator that takes you up and down efficiently. The jet engine that gets you home safely. The fire suppression system you hope you never need, but know is there. You count on things we make to protect you from harm, and even to keep you cool and comfortable. Our technologies are a critical part of your everyday life, yet many people don't even know who we are. Our name is United Technologies. We are Carrier, Hamilton Sunstrand, Otis, Pratt & Whitney, Sikorsky, and UTC Fire and Security. Six businesses united as one powerful company. In fact, we are one of the largest manufacturers in the United States, which likely makes us the biggest company you've never heard of, even though you depend on us every single day. United Technologies. Get to know more about us at UTC.com.
This week's Experts in Health topic is prostate health, featuring Dr. Antonio Michel, urologist with the Mid-Atlantic Permanente Medical Group at the Kaiser Permanente Falls Church Medical Center.
Prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men. While the causes of prostate cancer are unknown, risk factors such as age, race, ethnicity, and family history may increase a man's chance of getting prostate cancer. Prostate cancer is most commonly found in men age 65 or older and occurs in African American men more frequently than men of any other race. Prostate cancer is usually curable when detected early. Regular health checkups, including a digital rectal exam of the prostate and a PSA blood test, are vital to early detection. We at Kaiser Permanente encourage men to be proactive about their health and maintain regular health checkups with their doctor. Be well and thrive.
To learn more about Kaiser Permanente's Experts in Health, visit kp.org/midatlantic and click Meet Our Doctors. Attention civilian employees of the intelligence community and the Departments of Defense and State. You could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com/term life. That's GEBA.com/term life. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102. Contract series 83500.
Government IT executives, step into the past to start shaping the future. At this year's Executive Leadership Conference in Colonial Williamsburg, the American Council for Technology and the Industry Advisory Council's ELC Conference, October 23rd through the 25th, brings together government and industry leaders to address the acquisition, security, and human capital challenges you face in your increasingly mobile world. Register today at actgov.org. That's www.actgov.org.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the Federal News Countdown, with the three most important federal news stories of the week as chosen by Alan Valutis and Rob Burton. And, Rob, before we get to your number one story of the week, I have to mention something for Alan, or he's going to play a practical joke on me or something. You are involved with the Government Workforce Learning Innovations event on November 2nd at the museum. What is that all about?
At the museum.
Yes.
It is.
Didn't I say that?
I think you did. It
okay.
may be just that.
Okay. Yes, the museum.
The museum.
Right next to the Capitol building.
And this is the annual conference being put on by the Journal of the Public Manager and ASTD.
Mm-hmm.
Really focuses on some very important workforce issues. Has a stellar lineup
yep.
of speakers, including John Barry from OPM and Scott Gould from mm-hmm. the Department of Veterans Affairs. And I think it's a great event on an important topic. And I invite you all to attend it. I'm going to be sure you get a complimentary invitation.
Thank you very much. I see you have Mike Causey there, so
yeah,
that's good taste.
I mean that for you. Rob, you can pay twice. I mean, I think he's made $1,500 just in this 50 minutes we've been here working
on
some projects.
He was on his iPad, and I noticed he was typing an invoice.
I saw that during
the commercial break.
I was shocked and appalled.
We have a link for this at federalnewsradio.com
on
the in-depth page. Rob, your story number one this week is headlined, GAO Slams Agency Cyber Efforts. It's Jason Miller's story from federalnewsradio.com. This didn't sound very good. All 24 agencies GAO reviewed had weaknesses in security controls, and Jason details those. What did you see in this that really piqued you?
Well, let's face it. I mean, this is definitely a number one type news story.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's striking. It's I should have found something, Francis, a little more upbeat in the show, you know, because this is a real downer. And here it is, Cybersecurity Month, I want you to know.
Yes.
So it's probably appropriate that GAO releases this, and it's sort of a reality check. Everybody, as every agency, has serious weaknesses in security controls. And this is 10 years after Congress, I think, thought they were addressing the problem when they passed FISMA, mm-hmm. the Federal Information Security Management Act. So what's happened in 10 years? I mean, not a whole lot with respect to moving the ball forward. And
lots
as I said before, I think that cybersecurity is the really a huge challenge, and Secretary Lynn mentioned that as well.
Yep.
That we really have to put resources on this issue. And as we do these budget cuts, this is proof that we're hurting. We're really hurting because we're not going to really be able to address the GAO report effectively because the resources aren't going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But to think that we have this kind of systemic problem at every federal agency, I think, is very troubling. And did you notice also GAO found a lack of training, security training for federal employees? 17 out of 24 agencies cited weaknesses in their training programs.
Mm-hmm.
And here again, I'm sure training budgets are being cut as we downsize
yep.
at every agency. Now, Senator Collins, I totally agree. You know, she made some public comments regarding this GAO report. And here's the theme. And Senator Collins makes comment, too, about the need for stronger public-private partnerships. And I do think, Francis, that this is an area where the government needs to rely more on the private sector, because one thing I've learned since I left the government, especially in the area of cybersecurity, the private sector has enormous technology and innovative solutions that the government simply is not using.
Mm-hmm.
So it occurs to me that the senator's right. We've got to have that public-private partnership in this arena more than most any other.
Alan, I would love to give you a chance to respond, but we used up your time in this segment to plug your event, so I'm sorry about that. It's been great to have both of you on
Francis,
the show. Rob, good
so
to
much.
See you as always. Alan, it's always a pleasure to have you
thanks,
on the
Francis,
show.
Thanks for being here. Rob, always good to see you.
I have to be here. I don't really have any choice. But I appreciate the sentiment. Alan Baludis of Cisco, Rob Burton of Venable, my guests on the Federal News Countdown. And you can hear this program again anytime, posted online at federalnewsradio.com. Hour number two of In-Depth with Francis Rose right around the corner.